Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour, we will return to a subject that we have discussed before on the program. Maybe the focus will be slightly different. We'll be talking about immigration and look at something of the history of immigration to the United States. Now, a lot of our recent conversations have looked at the current controversy and debate about the problem of illegal immigration currently here into the United States. And we may indeed end up touching on that, but that's really not what we want to try to do in this program. I think what we want to try to do is get some context, some historical context, and maybe that will help us think a little bit better about immigration, both legal and illegal, now in the United States. And our guest for the program is an historian who has made a specialty of studying immigration, Donna Gabacha. She's professor of immigration history and also is director of the Immigration History Research Center. And that is based at the University of Minnesota. She is joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, comments will certainly be welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call in is just that they try to be brief in their comments. And we ask that so that we can get in as many people as possible and try to keep the program moving along. Anyone, though, who is listening can call. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. That is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So locally, 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you can pick up the telephone, give us a call, be a part of the conversation. Professor Gabacha, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks. And yourself?
I'm doing great.
Good. Well, I appreciate you giving us some of your time. I'm sure that it is the case that I could say without fear of contradiction, I could say that immigration has been very important in the history of the United States. I am guessing, and you can certainly tell me whether I am right or wrong about this, in fact, that immigration has been more important, has played a more important role in the history of the United States than probably almost any other country. Now, maybe indeed other people would say, oh, no, there are other examples. But I'm guessing that would be the case.
Yes. Well, actually, that's a really interesting observation because there are other countries in the world that have attracted proportionately in relationship to their population, more immigrants than the United States has. Mm. But it's a large country. It's always attracted the largest group at every period of time. And whereas other countries have had large immigrant populations, no country in the world today quite features immigration as prominently in its national history and its understanding of its national identity as the U.S. does. The U.S. Calls itself a nation of immigrants with more pride, more vigor, and also more frequency than countries like Argentina, for example, that at one time was 30% foreign-born, but doesn't really think of itself as a nation of immigrants in quite the same way that the U.S. does.
Well, that's, I guess, as soon as I started thinking that, I also started to reflect on how that thinking about being a nation of immigrants, about the fact that newcomers have always been regarded as a great source of strength. Their labor helped to build the country and their culture made it the kind of diverse place that it is, that in my thinking that it played a very important role here and perhaps more important in other places,
yeah,
just taps into that idea that we have about America, that it's always, and you have to acknowledge the fact that, yes, it has always been a source of strength, but it has frequently been a source of controversy, this question about who we're going to let to come here and what it is they have to go through to become a citizen.
That's correct, David. In fact, as an historian, what I always think is that each major wave of immigration into the United States, and there have been at least three of them, depending on how you count and divide up time, each major wave of immigration into the United States has sparked kind of a negative reaction. So we both celebrate the strengths, the resources, the labor, the cultural creativity that accompanies immigration, but even those celebrations of immigration have never quite prevented every generation of Americans faced with large numbers of newcomers to reflect and to worry a bit about the impact that they're going to have on American society. So I guess I would describe this as an ambivalent relationship in which Americans actually tend to celebrate the immigrants of the past while being skeptical of those in the present. And I think that's true today, and I think it was true in the past as well. In the 1880s, for example, many Americans looked back to the immigrants of the 1850s with nostalgia and said, oh, if only those people coming in from Southern and Eastern Europe in the 1890s were more like those people who came in from Germany, Scandinavia, and Ireland in the 1850s. Similarly, today we tend to look back to the immigrants of the turn of the century as, oh, those were the days when immigrants brought positive things into the United States, whereas in the present we tend, especially in recent policy debates, to focus more on the problems that the most recent arrivals from Latin America, Asia, Caribbean, and so forth and so on are posing for society.
I came across this fact, and I'm not sure if it's true, and maybe you would know. I certainly was struck by it, that and this comes from Wikipedia, font of all knowledge, so that may or may not be a great source.
Use, but use with caution.
Exactly so. But anyway, what it says in this particular article I was looking at about immigration to the United States, it says that as of 2006, the United States accepts more legal immigrants as permanent residents than the rest of the world combined. Do you think that's actually true?
I'm not quite sure if that is true. Now, you know, you'll remember what Mark Twain once said, lies, statistics. It's my understanding, and again, what legal immigrant means and whether refugees are included in this number for immigrants, I'm not sure. My understanding is that about a third of the 191 million people living outside their country of birth are living in the United States. Now, that suggests to me that two-thirds are elsewhere, and that's a bit different from what Wikipedia has to say. But it depends on how I'm using data on people living outside their country of birth. Immigrant is an interesting term. Sometimes immigrant means everyone, not refugees. Sometimes the term includes both legal and illegal. Sometimes the term includes only those foreigners who haven't yet naturalized or taken U.S. citizenship. And that's where controversies around numbers can easily emerge. But I think we are always safe in saying that the largest number of immigrants, the largest single group, go to the U.S. But it may very well be, and I believe it is in fact the case, that the U.S. Is only receiving about one-third of the mobile people of the world. So collectively, all the other nations put together are still more than the U.S. However, that's still one-third. And that means that today in the United States, about 12% of the population is foreign-born. And that's a significant number. It certainly is. Mm-hmm. But it's not even the peak that we've seen in the past when that's gone as high as 15%. Perhaps in the next census we'll find that we're at 15%. We're not there yet. And there are other countries in the world where the proportion is higher, including our very near neighbor Canada, where it's about 18%. In Australia, where it's been between 18 and 22% over the last 50 years or so.
Well, that also was a number that I saw and was not exactly sure how to think about that. Apparently, if you exclude the very, very early years of America before America, when the population who had been, you know, Europeans who came here, the number of people who are actually born on this side of the Atlantic would be small, that it's really never been more than about 16%.
Yes, that's the peak. And, of course, obviously that was reached, I think, several times in the 1850s, again in 1880, and then again in 1910. It then fell to a low of about 5% in the middle years of the 20th century, and since 1965 has gradually risen again to about 12%. We may be looking at 15% 10 to 20 years down the road. That really depends on what American policy and economy determines, I think. There have been times in the past where the U.S. has decided to stop that flow of migration. Many people today believe it's impossible to do that. Some of them advocate doing that. We haven't done it yet. But in the past, at least, there have been successful reversals in flows of immigration. That's why it sunk to 5%. in the middle years of the 20th century.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Donna Gabaccia. She is a professor of immigration history at University of Minnesota, where she also is director of the Immigration History Research Center. And this is a special area of research of hers. Questions are certainly welcome. We have someone here who is waiting patiently, and I will not make them wait longer. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here is our first caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. When recent immigration has been discussed in letters to the editor, for example, an argument that I've seen often has been something along the lines of, yes, America is a nation built by immigrants, legal immigrants. And I guess my understanding has been that until at some point fairly recently, like, I don't know, 40 or 50 years ago, but you would obviously know better, basically if you could get here, you were allowed to work and stay. You didn't have to apply for papers. So it wasn't an issue of who was legal versus who was illegal. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that to put things in more of a historical context, and I will listen offline. Thank you.
All right. That's
well, thank you. That's both a great observation and a great question, and actually I do have a few things to say about that. For one thing, I just used a search engine to search the digitized version of the New York Times, for example, to see when the term illegal immigrants was first used. And it was first used in 1923 to refer to Chinese immigrants who were seeking to enter the United States from Cuba. My grandfather entered the U.S. My great-grandfather, I'm sorry, from Italy, entered the United States the first time in the 1880s with no passport, with no paperwork whatsoever. And to a very real extent, it's been the effort to control and to restrict immigration that has created the concept of the illegal immigrant. This begins already in the 1880s when the United States restricts the entrance of workers from China. The first kind of effort by the U.S. to exclude a large number of immigrants whose labor was up to that point being used extensively in railroad building, mining, and other and agriculture, especially on the West Coast. So it's not an accident that the first reference in at least the New York Times is to Chinese as illegal immigrants, because the restriction of immigration into the United States began with the restriction of workers from China. That was extended over time to other restrictions against, for example, people advocating the overthrow of the American government. Okay, maybe that affected a small group. But the United States also excluded from entry, already in the early 20th century, people who might become what was then called a public charge. In other words, people who might not be able to support themselves and possibly end up dependent upon charity. And when you look at the figures for people excluded from the United States in the early 20th century, that means that the exclusions were most commonly exercised against women, because women traveling alone or without a male breadwinner attached, it was feared, would end up on charity. So the exclusion rates were higher for women in the early 20th century than they were for men. In the years between 1917 and 1924, the United States imposed a whole range of rather, by today's standards, draconic restrictions on immigration. That was when the level of the foreign-born starts to drop towards 5% that I mentioned earlier. Asians were simply excluded on a racial basis. They were excluded. You could not enter the U.S. legally as a person from Asia for those middle years of the century. Restrictive quotas, they're called the national origins quotas, were imposed on people from the old world. And those restrictive quotas were particularly small for the groups that had been entering the U.S. for the previous 20, 30 years in the largest numbers. They were small, for example, for Italians, for Poles, for people from the Balkans and from Greece. those restrictive quotas remained in place until 1965. And this combination of early exclusion of Asians and the restriction of groups, especially from Europe, that had been migrating in large numbers, not only resulted in a drop in the numbers of people entering and a rapid decline in the proportion of the U.S. population that was foreign-born, it also resulted in the rise of illegal immigration of the restricted groups. And there's interesting histories now being written of how groups have responded to restriction. There's an interesting literature on how the Chinese responded to the exclusion of Chinese workers, the creation of what was called paper sons, where people claimed to be relatives of the merchants who were allowed into the United States, or the children born in the U.S. prior to the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, and thus their birth records had been destroyed, so they would be exempt from this as American-born Chinese, exempt from this exclusion. Once the national origin quotas are put into place, the phenomenon of jumping ship, as it was called in U.S. In harbors, Italians or Greeks would sign on as merchant sailmen and then seamen and then jump ships, thereby becoming illegal immigrants. Alternatively, all of the restricted groups would try to enter the United States claiming to be Mexicans or Canadians because those borders at that time were less the focus of restriction and exclusion than they were today, right? The exclusion of Asians and the restriction of Europeans focused attention and focused on the problem of illegality in the port cities. So there's a history of exclusion that's very closely related to the history of illegality. And I would point to one other important turning point. You'll notice that in talking about exclusion and restriction in the early years of the 20th century, I focused on Asia and on the U.S. And Europe. In the years between 1920 and 1965, the nations of the New World, in other words, of our own hemisphere, were not subject to restrictive quotas. There was no number, upper limit, placed on the numbers of people allowed to enter the United States from Mexico and from Canada. And in fact, Canadians and Mexicans were the two largest immigrant groups through the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. At periods, the demand for labor in the U.S., especially during World War II, was so intensive that the U.S. government actually sought to recruit Mexicans to increase the number entering through what's known as the Bracero program. We would call that a guest worker program today. In 1965, Canada, Mexico, and all the other nations of the New World have a limit placed on the number of visas available to them for the first time. And it's really with that change that the focus of attention on the so-called illegal immigrant comes to rest very firmly on Mexicans, right? A group that had been, up to that point, actually often recruited vigorously, now found there were 30,000 visas available for them. Furthermore, among those 30,000 visas, very few of them were available to people who had kind of the skills to take blue-collar work. We have a preference system that allots those limited number of visas available to people from every country around the world, and the bulk of those visas go to reunite families of U.S. citizens and resident aliens who've been separated during migration. The smaller number go to support people whose labor is needed, and of those visas allotted to people with labor skills, most of them go to the highly skilled and the highly educated. So when I hear people say immigrants today should wait in line, just like the immigrants of the past, I usually say to them, if you look at U.S. policy, you will see that there is no line, especially for blue-collar workers. And needless to say, that is the group that features most prominently in our discussions of illegal immigration. Restriction and a preference system makes blue-collar workers illegal if they want to work. There isn't a line. for visas for that category of worker.
So just to pick up on, and this is one of the things I was wondering about, just to underline this, that in fact, if you are a person that you're seeking to immigrate and settle in the United States, if you are indeed someone who has a high level of desirable skills, and maybe you're a computer whiz, or maybe it's just as you're somebody who has significant resources, financial resources, that those people, in a sense, they get to have a higher up place in the queue just because of that?
Yes, that's one fair way of putting it, although the outcome is that even many people in those categories find they must wait, that there's a waiting line, often a long waiting line. And I think the really key point to make here is that the fastest way to move to the front of the line for these limited number of visas, about 350,000 or 400,000 of them available each year, the quickest way to move to the front of the line is actually not dependent upon what skills you have or don't have, but rather whether you have a relative in the United States who's a citizen. Most visas, most of the visa preferences, the things that move you forward in the waiting line, are to reunite families rather than to pursue some kind of labor policy or labor recruitment policy that moves up and down with the changes in the U.S. economy. So you're right. If you have skills, you move forward faster than if you don't have skills. If you have $10,000 to invest in a business in the United States, you move forward more quickly than if you're a sixth grade education worker who knows there's jobs in construction or restaurants, but that need doesn't produce a visa for you. But I wouldn't want to say that it's not easy for almost anyone to enter the United States in order to work. Our policy focuses to a very significant degree on reuniting families. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it is a dimension of U.S. policy that I don't see discussed in today's policy debates. Maybe the trade-off is between a national policy based on the needs of the labor market instead of the needs of families. It's sad to think about these two being played off against each other. But certainly when we talk about illegality, when we talk about the problems of immigration, I do think we need to understand better how U.S. policy works today and in the past. There's a reason that congressmen choose to privilege family members. They're voters in many cases, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a complicated issue, and the only observation that I would make as an historian about today's policy debates is that so few of the debaters seem to understand how current policy works and how the privileging of kinship and relatives and family ties plays into the number of visas that then are available to high-skill or low-skill workers.
We are at our midpoint here. Let me introduce again our guest, Donna Gabacha. She's a professor of immigration history at University of Minnesota. She's also director of the Immigration History Research Center there. She teaches in a number of areas, including immigration and American diversity, also food and culture, U.S. social history, U.S. women's history, and has done writing and research in these areas as well. She's talking with us here on telephone this morning about immigration and the history of immigration to the United States. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have a couple of callers here, again, who'd like to join the conversation. Charleston, the next person, and that is line number 4. Hello?
Yes. Two things, and then I'd like a comment, if I could. The idea of immigration occurs to me that someone is either fleeing from something or fleeing to something, whether by choice or other means, such as a slave trade, where they had no choice in the matter and sold by the locals and all of that. But in modern times, especially after 1792, it appears to me that the capitalist paradigm, when they needed labor of whatever sort, then the doors were opened and then conveniently closed. And today's madness about illegal Mexican labor has been here for a long time, if I understand properly. But could your guest address those issues?
Well, I'd be happy to. I think your distinction between people who flee from and others who are attracted to, and your focus on how much choice people exercise in coming to the United States, is a really very useful one. Many people distinguish between immigrants who choose often to come to the U.S. in order to work from refugees who are fleeing from another country. And, in fact, refugees are treated somewhat differently under U.S. immigration policy. There's both a certain number of visas set aside for them, but historically, most refugees who have been allowed into the United States have been entered in by either an act of Congress, a special act of Congress, or a special act of the president. So this is a useful distinction, and also it is a good idea, I think, to think about how much choice people exercise in coming to the U.S., the decision to leave, how negative conditions seem to them in their homelands, the decision to come to the U.S. rather than some other country, and the degree of choice that our policies allow people. I think the caller is absolutely correct to remind listeners that in some cases the entrance into the United States was not a voluntary one, that the demand for labor did often create terribly oppressive systems of recruitment, including slavery and what we call indentured labor, where people sign a contract kind of giving themselves over to their employer for 7 years in exchange for a free trip across the Atlantic or, in some cases, across the Pacific. The caller is also right that migration from Mexico to the United States is nothing new. It began to increase fairly rapidly already in the 1880s. That's a very long time ago, when the United States investors began building railroads from Mexico into the United States and developing the industries of mining, in particular, in northern Mexico. Mexicans then began to enter the U.S. in very large numbers as California and then Arizona and Texas agriculture demanded workers. I mentioned earlier that demand for labor in the U.S., especially during World War II, was so intense that the U.S. and the Mexican government agreed to recruit workers for wartime industry and agriculture in the U.S. through the Bracero program. The caller's comments really point our attention to labor as a major, not the only, but a major driver of immigration policy and immigration patterns.
Well, this, and I hope the caller will forgive me, I'm going to jump in here because the lines are full and we're
sure
getting
are.
Into our we're past the midpoint here. Just though, I do want to ask, if you look at the reasons that people choose, that they would give to come to the United States today, and then look at the reasons that people came to the United States, say, 100 years ago, would they be essentially the same?
They are very similar. The largest group of people, whether they're computer technicians and doctors and nurses or blue-collar workers, see the United States as a place where hard work and often self-sacrifice on the part of the workers will generate a better life for their family in the future. Or alternatively, for the smaller group, they see the United States as a safe place of refuge from the political turmoil and hostility and violence of their homelands. And that's true today, and that was true 100 years ago, and that was true in the 1850s.
All right, we'll go on next to someone in the nearby community of Belgium, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I'd like to direct your discussion in another direction slightly, in that people don't realize how hard it is for us to go from this nation to other nations. Many, many nations don't take people at all. Liechtenstein and several small countries don't take people. And then New Zealand, it makes it very, very difficult for people to immigrate there. So I don't understand why we're so upset about people having immigration problems when other places are far worse than we are.
That's a really interesting comment, and it calls attention to the fact that worldwide, at least since the periods of World War I and World War II, worldwide, the focus of attention in all nations in the world has been to restrict and not to welcome. That's an important fact to emphasize. The U.S. is not unique in restricting, and other countries are, in fact, far more restrictive than the United States. I like to ask people, well, what country in the world in our times has the highest proportion of foreigners living on its soil? And the answer is actually the United Arab Emirates, where workers in the oil fields are badly needed, but none of them can settle permanently. They're all guest workers. 85% of the population, at least a few years ago, 85% of the population of the United Arab Emirates were foreign-born. They were foreign workers, and it was expected that they were going to go home again. They would never naturalize. They would never become citizens. They're not what we in the United States actually would call immigrants. They're foreign workers. And so I do think it's important to put U.S. policies and U.S. practices in comparative perspective. We're neither the most restrictive nor are we the most welcoming. There are other countries, especially in Latin America, that continue to have somewhat more open immigration policies than does the United States. One of the most interesting comparisons to be made is between the U.S. and Mexico. In the same way that U.S. citizens are concerned about entry without papers from Mexico into the U.S., Mexico is concerned about the entry of Guatemalans and El Salvadorans into Mexico. So this is a worldwide problem, and it's quite fascinating, actually, to draw comparisons between the U.S. and other countries.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's go to another caller here. This is someone in Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. My question is about immigration and voting rights. I have lived in the U.S. since 1985, from Germany originally. And
Schönen guten Tag.
Guten Tag. And I have been a permanent resident since 93. Of course, I've worked the whole time, but have never been able to vote. And as long as I keep my green card and my German citizenship, I will apparently not be able to vote. And I'm wondering two things. I mean, one is, how large do you think the number of immigrants is who do not have voting rights, and how does that affect politics in the U.S.? And the second question, I'm not even sure exactly how to ask it, but so what do you think about this idea that there's an expectation that we, as immigrants, sort of reject our origin and become citizens mm-hmm. in order to get voting rights?
Okay, these are two very complicated questions in a way. What I can tell you is that somewhere between 35 and 40%, I believe, of foreign-born people in the U.S. are citizens, right? That the rate of choosing citizenship varies from group to group.
Yes.
Canadians are the least likely to become U.S. citizens and to remain as kind of long-term resident aliens with green cards in the U.S. Naturalization rates are higher in other groups. But historically, this is actually a little bit higher than we would have seen 100 years ago, when rates of return to places like Italy, Greece, the Balkans, and Eastern Europe were pretty high. So there's that issue. Second, in U.S. history, if we look at voting rights for foreigners, you will see that in the years prior to the Civil War, voting rights were actually determined by states. And some states did let foreigners vote, at least at the local level, prior to naturalization and to the acceptance of U.S. citizenship. Once the sort of rules of voting were transferred to the federal government, that occurred in the aftermath of the Civil War and the efforts of the federal government to protect the rights of the emancipated slaves, those practices of allowing unnaturalized foreigners to vote diminished.
Yeah.
And this is what creates the status of the caller today. He can't vote until he becomes a citizen. There are other countries in the world where non-citizens are allowed to vote if they're longtime residents,
yes,
including in Germany,
right,
if I'm
exactly
not mistaken.
Right, exactly. The
second question is a more complicated one. You're asking whether taking on citizenship implies or requires a kind of cutting off of sentiments and attachments to,
yeah,
the homeland. Is that what you're asking?
In a way, it seems that there's an expectation. In part, it's expressed, of course, through voting rights, that there's kind of a cutting off of one's own citizenship. And maybe in some cases, people would like to do that because they are refugees, have been tortured in their countries, and don't want to be associated with their country of origin anymore. But I guess for many people that is quite different, that they're coming here because, you know, they find that this is a good place to live. But in the same way they would maybe move within Germany to another location because they like it there, but they would not think of cutting off their...
I think here we do see some interesting change over time and,
yes,
some differences between past and present.
Right.
In the 19th and early 20th century, and especially in the years around World War I, the United States and most Americans did see naturalization and loyalty to one country only, as extremely important.
Yes.
And there was the expectation that when you became a U.S. citizen, as a foreigner, you were supposed to abandon not just your loyalties, but your other social and cultural,
yes,
ties to the homeland. We know, however, and I know from my own family experience, since I'm in a family where there's been movement across the Atlantic for four straight generations, that the acquisition of citizenship is often highly instrumental and completely unrelated to how people either maintain or abandon social and emotional,
yes,
ties to their homeland. Social and emotional ties, we now know, were very common among immigrants in the past, whether they naturalized and became U.S. citizens or not.
Yeah.
I find it useful to demonstrate that, in fact, many people acquire U.S. citizenship while maintaining ties abroad, especially social and emotional ones. And that was true then, and it's true now. One thing, however, has changed over time is that the U.S. and other nations around the world have become more sympathetic to dual citizenship,
yes,
which was anathema to the political thinkers of a century ago and remains a very controversial issue, since in times of warfare, dual citizenship and loyalty and obligations literally to fight in the,
yes,
armies of more than one country can be a real problem.
Right.
We have just lived through a relatively, and I say relatively, peaceful period in world history. If we were to return to a world of the type we saw in the middle years of the 20th century, where international warfare was the main form of interaction among nations,
right,
then dual citizenship could again become anathema.
Yeah.
So it's useful to distinguish between people's kind of civic connections,
yes,
to countries and their emotional and social ones. And I think the United States, with its tolerance and more recently celebration of cultural diversity, acknowledges that people can have multiple emotional, social, and cultural ties,
yes,
while being full-standing, fully legitimate, and good citizens of the United States.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. I really appreciate the fact that the caller brought up this question that goes to these issues of identity and assimilation, because that seems to be so much part of the debate that we're having now. Maybe that's always been a part of the debate, but it seems to me to be a really important point that part of this national myth or this way we have thinking of immigration, there's the conventional wisdom is that in the past, people came here and they essentially cut. They burned the bridge.
Yes, that was absolutely not the case.
And that is absolutely not the case. And it may indeed be that now, provided one has the means, it's maybe easier. It's easier to go back and forth. It may well be. Well, I don't know. It may well be
in
that
terms of transportation.
In terms of transportation,
it's easier to go back and forth. But in fact, I mean, the historians acknowledge that There were large numbers of immigrants who left the United States. I had two generations of my own family who went back and forth before settling in either Italy or in the U.S. It was very common in the past for people to circulate rather than to immigrate. And the cutting of ties has been vastly exaggerated. If you look at your own family stories, you may, in fact, discover that to be the case.
Let's continue here. Maybe I should just also very quickly introduce again our guest, Donna Gabacha. She is professor of immigration history and also director of the Immigration History Research Center at University of Minnesota. And we're talking some about the history of immigration to the United States. We have a couple of other callers. Next, we'll talk with someone in Chicago. Line one. Hello.
Hello. I have a question about the attitudes of the nation of Japan towards immigration. They have a similar problem as Europe and the United States as far as low birth rates, but I understand that they resist immigration. Is that correct, or is that just a misconception on my part?
I know less about Japan than many other parts of the world, but overall, I would say that your generalization is a correct one. This is sometimes explained through sort of an islander's mentality that Japan values cultural homogeneity more than some other nations do. But you are correct that that sort of policies in Japan are highly restrictive. Japan has a need, and has at times had a need for workers that outstrip the ability of the Japanese population to fulfill. In recent years, there's been an enormous amount of scholarly attention placed on Japan's willingness to accept what they think of as return migrants from Japanese populations or Japanese origin populations abroad. There was a significant movement back to Japan, if you will, from Brazil, where there's a sizable Japanese-Brazilian population. Some of those people were second, what we in the United States would call second and third generation. They didn't always speak Japanese. Culturally, they were, in fact, quite Brazilian, although they didn't realize it till they returned to Japan. Japan's nationality law allows people of Japanese descent from abroad to reclaim their citizenship very quickly if they return home, so to speak, and I put that in quotation marks. And Japan is not unique in that. Germany has had a similar law. Italy has also had a similar law, and we've seen returns of German origin people to Germany in large numbers, for example, after World War II. We've seen returns of Argentinians, for example, of Italian descent to Italy when Argentina's national economy tanked and Italy's was on the rise. So all of these things, I think, at least help us to put Japan's restrictiveness and its preference for people of Japanese descent as if membership in the Japanese nation is passed through blood, or Italian nation passed through blood, or German nationality passed through blood. Japan is perhaps more restrictive, but that principle that people of Japanese descent elsewhere, or of Italian or of German descent, remain somehow more German, Japanese, or Italian than others is part of policy in not just Japan, but other countries too.
Well, how does Japan plan for its demographic problem, though, as far as, you know, the aging population and, you know, lack of younger employees? How do they account for that?
Well, I wish I could tell you more about the Japanese case. It's not one that I know very, very much about. But your observation that they seem not to be planning for that demographic change could equally be made of many European nations. Europe, as I'm sure you know, allows free movement within its own borders, but it's pretty hostile at the moment to what they call people outside the EU. They're called extra communitarians in Italian. It's sort of an interesting concept. Europe faces a very sharp decline in fertility. Italy and many other European nations are below replacement. And yet that has had very little impact on restrictive policies. It's quite interesting that whether in Japan or in Europe or even in the United States, immigration policy is not debated and discussed in relationship to the demographic transition, which does have citizens in all of these places reproducing at below replacement rate. In fact, sometimes when I listen to people complain about immigrants in the United States, I just want to say, hey, you know, they're going to be paying for your Social Security in the years ahead because your own children are too few in number to do it. But that trade-off between, or that relationship really, between demographic projections and policies, either restrictive or welcoming, is not taking place, not in Japan, not really in Europe, and not in the U.S., although specialists on demography know that it's a problem in all three of these places.
We are very close to the end of our time. I would like to try to get at least one more caller. This is someone in Charleston, line number 4.
Charleston, South Carolina?
No, it's Charleston, Illinois.
Charleston, Illinois, okay.
and the home of Eastern Illinois University, other things. And I'll have to ask you, Charleston caller, you got to be a little quick for us, but please go ahead.
Okay.
Yes.
Quick question. Social Security numbers for immigrants. We have two universities there, Lakeland and Eastern. The first year they have to work strictly on campus, I understand it. And they're restricted the number of hours they can work to get a Social Security number to get a car so they can stay the other 4 years.
Are you talking about international students or are you talking about faculty and staff?
Why do we make it so hard for them to get Social Security numbers the first year so they can get a driver's license to stay the other 3 years?
This is a complicated visa issue, and again, if we're talking about international students, each type of visa that allows people to enter the United States have different restrictions attached to it. Those are set; those are elements of federal policy, right? I think at the local level, those restrictions, especially on international students, but sometimes also on faculty and staff, cause kind of real problems for people who seek to hire, whether they're students, whether they're, you know, grown-up professional workers or, you know, have skills that the employer needs. Why we do this has to do, again, with the fact that we have an immigration policy that's main purpose is to restrict, right? We've got a total number of around 400,000 in mind. It doesn't matter whether there's a demand for labor in the United States or a depression. That number is fixed at the federal level. It is not altered year to year. And the purpose of attaching restrictions to visas is also something that's put in place and then remains in place regardless of what's happening on the ground in labor markets. So there is this kind of disjuncture that many employers and job seekers experience. Demand for labor can go up, but the availability of visas and the restrictions placed on each of those kinds of visas doesn't change year to year.
Well, we are going to have to stop. I'm sorry we have some folks that we can't take, but we've just kind of come to the end of the time. And we have to actually, and just a tiny bit early because of our noontime picking up of the governor's budget address. So there we must land with our thanks to Donna Gabacha. She's professor of immigration history and director of the Immigration History Research Center at University of Minnesota. Professor Gabacha, thanks very much.
Well, thank you, David. It was a pleasure talking with you and your listeners.